Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mercury Midday News here on Radio UTD. We are streaming live from the Student Union located in sunny, beautiful Richardson, Texas. Definitely a beautiful day, looking like we skipped spring and went straight to summer, but I am not complaining. We are the student-run radio station for the University of Texas at Dallas. If you'd like to call in at any point during the show, the number is 972-883-6305, or I am Radio UTD, all one word, on Skype. You can also tweet at us at Merc, M-E-R-C, Midday News spelled the normal way. I am Kara Santucci. I am your co-host and producer of the show here alone in the studio today, but that's okay. We've got a stacked show for you guys. We're going to start off with the news, and then I'll explain a little bit. But going forward, we're going to have bits of a Q&A that I conducted with Professor Annalise Hines and Professor Shiley Warren, who both work in arts and humanities, who do a special focus on women's studies and feminism. And I interviewed them a few weeks ago for a story that came out in this last paper about the Women's March and what that means for feminism going forward. So that's really cool, and they have some really interesting things to say, so that'll be up on deck. After that, we have Sarah Asprey, a registered dietitian of the Student Wellness Center, coming in to talk to us about the programming she and her office is doing for Eating Disorder Awareness Month. So she'll be here in studio talking with us, answering your questions. If you have any, call in. Tweet at us if you have questions, but in general, we'll just be talking about the importance of Eating Disorder Awareness Month and what that means at UTD. So let's get started. The weather for this weekend: Thursday, high of 84, low of 53 with slight wind, slower than they expected today. It's not super windy. Friday, 72 to 41, sunny. Saturday, 59 to 41, sunny. And then Sunday, 71 to 56, and also sunny. Going to be a beautiful weekend. The Dow is up 25.46. NASDAQ is down 29.46. A couple of campus events for the week. Meteor Theater is showing Doctor Strange, the new Marvel movie, relatively new Marvel movie, from 7 to 9 p.m. in the Student Services Edition. I've been hearing that those showings have been super crowded and people have been turning away, so get there early, get your seat, and check it out. Baseball is playing Hendricks College in a non-conference match at 2 p.m. on the baseball field. I believe that's this Saturday. And then the Mardi Gras lunch, I think, is next Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Dining Hall West. Check the comment calendar for those dates because I did not write those down because it has been a crazy week already. But to get started, I'm going to play some new music. Then I'll come back and we'll be on air and we'll be playing the Q&A from the Women's March. So enjoy Visit Me from Frontier Ruckus' new album, Enter the Kingdom.
I'm in sweatpants for the series finale of their discontinued fall prime times. Meredith's Massachusetts with a colonial toothache and the leaves are acre burning themselves. So I'm home watching my dad watch the NFL alone. Wish I still had that eternal telephone. I'd call you, call you. So come on down and visit me. My condition petitioned so implicitly. Cereal dispenser, want those eyes you made at me, those bedside globes, those orbs. I want your spilled coffee burning my inner thighs, the watermarks that measure my oscillating size when it dries and absorbs. So come on down. I need you.
Hi, I'm Summer LaBelle, and I'm the sports editor at UTD Mercury, and you're listening to Mercury Midday News on Radio UTD.
The issue of intersectionality, you brought that up already, and it seems like your impression was it was better represented in this march than, you know, previous marches where it was an issue. But I read those opinions, and I don't know, it just seems like there's some disagreement about whether the intersectionality represented was enough.
Yeah.
So what was your impression of that particular part of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two things that we should probably talk about, is one of which is the media coverage of the march leading up to it and then afterwards. So that would be like the major news sources, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times and sources like that, which was one of the stories, I think, Annalise sent you, right? Which is so what is that story, right? What is that story about the march? What's the narrative that's evident there? And then I certainly think that personal experiences of the march are valuable and interesting. However, there were 1.something million people there, right? So you're going to get a lot of different versions of what that march was like.
The latest number is over a million. Yeah. The initial estimates were 500,000 because that's all the camera could see.
Right.
That there were other streets. Yeah. So a lot of people.
There were a lot of people, and so there were many different experiences to be had there. But I guess for me, I think I would say that this is a very complicated story, and I do feel like that the media has tended to privilege this sort of debate about disunity within feminism, and that's been true, you know, literally, you know, since the first movement, you know, of suffragettes and, you know, the issue of race within the suffragette movement. So the media historically has been very interested in identifying conflict within feminism. And here's the thing, is like feminism has also been very interested in examining its own issues of conflict throughout history, right? So very few people would say that feminism is a perfect movement, or that it represents all people equally, or that it has nothing to do with, you know, this. So I'm very interested in teasing out those differences, mm-hmm. right? Between like, what did the march forward as its platform and its goals? Who was in charge of this matter? What was the leadership? What were the issues being raised on the stage, right? How did the march present itself to the public, which was very much as a movement of intersectional feminism, interested in justice of many, many kinds, right? That's what the march said it was. What did the media say the march was? The media said the march was a point of conflict between different kinds of women. You know, neither of these are the full picture of what the march really was. But I do remain slightly skeptical of the kind of media's obsession with feminism as being a race problem, which, you know, is just very limited, and I feel like a very sort of knee-jerk reaction to what feminism has tried to do throughout history. So
something I've also heard you say,
yeah.
Was a good way to capture it, was the difference between saying race is a problem because feminism is a white women's movement and
right.
white women don't know what to do with race,
right.
versus race is a point of conflict in feminism because feminism is an extremely diverse movement, and so race is a point of race is going to be there and is going to be a point of conflict.
Yeah.
Those are two.
It belongs
both,
there. Like, that conflict belongs within feminism.
Exactly.
Right? It's not challenging this thing called feminism.
Right.
In fact, feminism is a place in which kind of questions of equity are, right, at the heart.
Right.
So that comes in so many forms.
The point is that the people who are, I think, in charge, and much of the leadership of this march were pretty explicit in saying, this is a process of ongoing growth. Of course, it's not enough. You're right. Let's keep going.
It's just important to keep talking about it then.
And not just talk, but really change. And that is going to be an ongoing project. And if we really want to stay engaged, we really want this to be a diverse movement, it's going to remain an ongoing project. But feminism can help be at the forefront of that, and I think as much of what's driving these larger conversations of social justice. And if feminism becomes a mainstream organizing way of talking about intersectional issues of social justice, I think that that will help larger causes of social justice and help feminism. I have some thoughts, but I don't mean to cut you off.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking about this in as a historian, in part because that was, you know, this very apt point you bring up of strong echoes. And history is, of course, we know, we all live with history, whether or not we recognize it. But in this context, history has also been very, very present throughout even also the presidential campaign, this sense of historicity of this is going to be the first major female presidential candidate, possibly the first female president. What does that mean? What does that mean on the heels of having the first African-American male president? And, you know, talking about what will it mean for women of color if we have a white woman president? What issues are at risk of getting ignored? Those conversations were already happening before the election. And then I think within the value of thinking about this historically or what history can bring to this is also understanding the pain points within people who are having a sense of, I don't know if this is for me. Am I welcome here? Are you going to have my back when your rights are less obviously at stake? Where are you going to be at the next Black Lives Matter march? Right? We saw those signs. So understanding the pain points within the history of feminism, but also within a broader sense of this country and social movements, history of pain points that Black women have experienced within also the civil rights movement, right? They're situated in a point of intersectionality that has repeatedly erased their contributions. And that has been true within feminism. As Shyla points out, it has also been a real topic of conversation within feminism because women have been concerned about that. 1970s feminists are the ones also Black and white women who are talking about Harriet Tubman as an early feminist, right? She was at the forefront of movements for women's rights and abolitionism in the 19th century. Part of my concern with having a conversation that frames feminism in the past and the women's rights, the women's march today, as a white women's movement is that it further erases the real essential centrality of women of color to these struggles for social justice from the beginning. And this is part of the problem with the waves structuring. It's very convenient. It's useful to talk about it in waves. But what we lose is a sense that feminism is, in fact, so much more than, for example, the right to vote. So the right to vote also had many aspects. That campaign had many kind of organizations devoted to that. There were African-American women like Ida B. Wells actively campaigning for female suffrage while actively campaigning for lynching, recognizing that lynching was preventing African-American men from accessing the vote, right? She's a feminist. She's part, and she was in fact involved with feminists who were calling themselves feminists at the turn of the century when this word came into being. But yet, to not recognize her as a suffragist, to not recognize her as someone who refused to march in the back in the 1913 suffrage march, which was the original organization, once again erases them and further, I think, contributes to a sense of dislocation for women of color within a movement that I think is, in fact, they have long been central to. And so simultaneously, there is a need to recognize and heal and grow from those pain points and also not let them be points of division that actually slow or hurt the momentum, which race has long been used very intentionally by individuals and groups who are opposed to these kinds of social changes. Race has long been used as a divide and conquer strategy. And so to say that does not negate the real issues and real experiences of discrimination that Black women and other women of color have experienced, and gay women have experienced within kind of mainstream feminism. And it's important to say, let's pay attention to the narratives we're getting, who's telling them, and what is the whole picture. And to say that this women's march was a white women's organization is so disrespectful to the leadership of this group, which was majority women of color, And I think this relates to what Shiley was saying earlier, where this, and something we talked about in class, of the challenge of solidarity across difference. And that is both a real challenge and a possibility for a kind of points of division, both internal and external, and also one of feminism's greatest strengths, this idea of diversity and understanding points of commonality and actually committing to being there when one's own immediate rights are not obviously at stake.
Do you think that the way that the media and certain people without full understanding of the movement are presenting that issue of intersectionality is erasing the existing contribution of
yes.
intersectionality?
I do. Okay. I think it potentially negates this idea that for a long time, these conversations, before the word intersectionality mm-hmm. was a mainstream word, these conversations have been started largely by men and women of color. Mm-hmm. This same idea has been at the heart of much of these conversations and has been a point of self-criticism and exploration. And that I also worry that they are erasing the leadership, the long-term leadership of women of color.
So then the right way to talk about would be sort of, this is what we have right now, but this is what we should be doing more, right? Like, it's important to include the first part of it. Like, what's the best way
to that? Hey, so what's the alternative, how to frame it?
Yeah.
Well, I've also been thinking that, you know, I'm actually slightly uncomfortable with the word movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking about this a lot because I've seen so many representations. Okay, so now, is this a new movement? Like, and I saw somewhere the idea that, like, feminism is a tent where not everybody feels welcome. Or, you know, this idea that's, like, feminism as a one thing, right, is an idea, like, I fundamentally disagree with. And I think it's just not true to its history. So
just part of the problem with waves.
It's the problem of, like, of every, you know, it was never a movement, right? It's not a singular thing. It's not like you don't get a card and belong to this one place. Not every feminist in America shows up to the same place at the same time, right? It just doesn't work that way. It's not logistically correct. It's not empirically real. What happens is that a lot of people working desperately on many issues throughout the country suddenly feel like they need to come together, you know, in a particular time and space, and that's what happened. It was a march. It was like it was a moment in which everybody said, oh wait, we may all have different commitments, right? Like, I may be working on animal rights, or I may be working on environmental issues, I may be working on police brutality, I may be working on trans visibility, whatever it is, right? Suddenly we were like, oh, you know, I see how we're all connected, right? Like, we all must come together to resist this, right? This is clearly something we all oppose. And that's a moment in which it feels like a movement, right? But it's always a movement. I mean, I've been doing, you know, feminism in my way, you know, for, you know, a very long time. And so I think I would also say, like, It can't do anything because it doesn't actually exist, right? There's no, we don't actually have a leader. We single out these people that organize this event. We had an event, right? And we had a powerful event.
That was a coalition. It was inherently a
was
coalition.
Was it perfect? You know, perfect? I don't even know what would it look like. It would look like every single human on the planet, right, coming together to, like, work for justice. Is that going to happen? You know, not yet. But so that's what I'm like, what do we think it could be? I'm not sure exactly. Like, if every person who felt oppressed in America came together at one moment and said, like, no way, all right, you know, that would be perfect. But that's, you know, that's not realistic. What we have instead, we have an event that brought diverse coalitions around the country together under a banner largely headed by women, and largely headed by women of color. And that's amazing, right?
Hi, I'm Bharat Armili, and I'm the web editor for the UTD Mercury, and you're listening to Mercury Midday News on Radio UTD.
Hello, everyone, and we are back in studio with Sarah Asprey, a nutritionist for the Student Wellness Center at UTD. Is that all correct?
Yes.
Okay. And she is here to talk to us about some of the programming her office will be doing for Eating Disorder Awareness Week, which is part of, is it a whole month? It is Eating Disorder Awareness Month, right? Or is it just a week?
It's just a week.
Okay.
Because it actually, the official week is determined by the National Eating Disorder Association, and it actually is overlapping between February and March this year. So it starts next week, and it'll end, you know, on like March 2nd, I believe.
So I know we were talking a little bit before we got on air what UTD will be doing and what the Wellness Center will be doing. So can you talk us through the events, I guess, that will be going on next week?
So next week, on Monday, we're going to start off with an event called Mirrors on the Mall. And so we did this last year, and it was really well received. So we decided to do this multiple days in a row so that we can reach more students. And so what we're going to do is we're going to be set up on different parts of campus each day, and we're going to have a big board that has full-length mirrors hung on it. And we're going to be encouraging people to stop by and engage with their reflection and write something positive on the mirror directly with a dry erase marker.
Okay.
And so we're going to be there from 12 to 2 on Monday. I believe it's at Chess Plaza. Oh, wait, no, Monday is in the Activity Center.
Okay.
And then Tuesday it's on the plinth. Wednesday it's on Chess Plaza. And then Thursday we'll be out by the residence halls. So we're hoping to just get everyone to take 30 seconds to engage with their reflection and think about something positive that they see and try to embrace that we all have a body and that it's really important and valuable. And that we should really kind of try to encourage ourselves to see positivity in it and not negativity and criticism that we often tend to do when we look at our reflections. We'll also be passing out different snacks that are just kind of punny, if you will. So we have, like, there are so many raisins to love your body and those sorts of things just to try to, again, continue the positivity around our bodies. And Tuesday night, we have our Time Out Tuesday event. So the Student Wellness Center, the last Tuesday of every month, we partner with the Counseling Center, and we do like a stress management activity, like something fun, something to encourage students to take a break. And so for next week's, we are doing a spa night over in Residence Hall Northwest, or it's in North, sorry, it's in Residence Hall North. And so we'll be doing different types of spa activities, like making our own bath scrubs and salt scrubs, and we'll have nail polish, and we'll have face masks and relaxing music, and we'll have information about eating disorders and what that looks like, and encouraging students to engage in that conversation. We do have another event on Wednesday night where we're actually hosting a panel of three local medical doctors who work with eating disorders, and they will be doing a discussion, kind of like a TED Talk of sorts, about the medical implications of eating disorders. And so that is going to be in the Davidson Auditorium in JSOM from 6 to 8. And one last thing is that we have body project sessions that are going to be starting next week. And so we have three different sessions for the body project scheduled for the spring semester. And the first one starts on Monday. And so the body project on campus is a peer-led discussion amongst UTD females around our bodies and how we feel about them. So we'll get together and challenge the thin ideal and just our perception of beauty and how that's different for everybody. And so it's a very powerful, impactful, about 2 hours. So it's a two-session series, though. So a group will get together one night for 2 hours, and it is led by trained students. And they went through a full week in training with the Counseling Center and myself around how to do this. And they have a script that they follow, and it's research-based out of an eating disorder treatment center in Denver. So they'll go through this script together and really challenge things like the thin ideal. They'll challenge fat talk together and try to change the conversation around our bodies. And then they'll meet again the following week for another 2 hours to then discuss more about the impact that that first session had on them. And there's just like a small homework assignment they do in between, but it's really wonderful. And so we'd love for more students to get involved with that initiative as well.
Body Project, is that a club on campus, sort of, in a sense?
Yeah, kind of.
Because they operate independently of the Eating Disorder Awareness Week, right?
Yes. So yes, because we'll do Body Project sessions throughout the whole school year. We typically offer 2 to 3 series of sessions each semester. It's not an official organization because it is run through the Counseling Center and the Wellness Center. So it's kind of a departmental run initiative, but students are the leaders and we do train them, and but it's not something that you would find on OrgSync.
Right. So you said Body Project was female restricted.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what's like some of the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So the Body Project is a copyrighted research-based program, and so we have to follow their rules. And so their research was only done with females. When they introduced males into the process, it interfered with the vulnerability and the conversation mm-hmm. of the group. And so they are currently working and trying to develop a script just for males. It's just not finished at this time.
Right. Okay, cool. So those are some of the events that we'll see going on next week, Monday through Friday or Monday through Thursday?
Yeah, it'll mainly be Monday through Thursday. Students aren't all typically here on Fridays, so we try to concentrate programming Monday through Thursday. But we'll be doing mirrors on the mall from 12 to 2 each day, and then we'll have the Body Project session starting Monday night, spa night on Tuesday, and the medical panel on Wednesday.
Is there a list of all those events on the website, on the Student Wellness Center website?
So they're not directly on the website, but they are on our Facebook page.
Okay.
So I highly encourage students to like us on Facebook. The Student Counseling Center's Facebook page will also be advertising the same events.
Okay. So I know we were going to talk about the events and then maybe talk a little bit more about the impetus behind the events. Why are we talking about this? Why is it important? So where would you like to start?
Sure. So when we look at eating disorders, I think culturally, you know, we have a lot of thoughts and beliefs around, you know, and perceptions, if you will, around what this looks like. So, you know, we might think that eating disorders predominantly occur in females, which is true. We might think that it mainly is something that we're worried about in young females, like maybe 13 to 16-year-olds, that they have to be Caucasian and they have to be blonde and live in the suburbs, right?
Right.
So we tend to kind of have these ideas and stereotypes around what an eating disorder looks like, and they have to be thin, right? So they have to be really skinny, and it's just not true. Eating disorders are just as diverse as we are as human beings, and we find that college is a very high-risk time period, because what happens is you might have someone who might have dabbled some with disordered eating, as a lot of teenagers do, but then they go off to college and they don't have someone feeding them dinner on a nightly basis, or teachers who see them on a daily basis, and friends who see them regularly at lunchtime and know and can monitor what they're eating. You have much more freedom to feed yourself all of a sudden, and freedom to maybe explore what some of those behaviors might look like for you. Not to mention, you also have the added stress of a huge change in your life. And now all of a sudden, you're not living at home anymore. You're living on your own. You are on a huge campus, and you're not in the same student organizations or around the same friends. You might feel homesick. You might feel really overwhelmed just by the amount of school and homework you have to do, and it feels really hard and stressful, and finals are so different in a college atmosphere than they ever were in high school. And so we find that a combination of all of that together definitely increases the risk for disordered eating and eating disorders. And we find that college is the prime time for eating disorders to really get severe for most people.
More severe than the 13 to 16 perception, you would say?
Yes.
So what does that severity look like? What do you mean by severe?
So, you know, eating disorders are different for everybody in terms of behaviors, but it might be that, you know, someone might have, you know, been comfortable eating a couple times a day whenever they were at home, because their parents would see them at breakfast time and dinner time, and maybe they would just restrict lunch. Well, now no one's watching them all day long, and so now we see the restrictive behaviors maybe go that much more extreme around they're not going to eat all day, or they're just going to eat once a day, or they're just going to have, like, some small snacks. They, you know, it's more convenient, really, in this environment to come up with reasons as to why you're not hungry. You already ate. You know, people don't, again, they don't feed you. They don't know what that looks like for you. We might find that, you know, people were maybe denied access to foods from their parents, you know, foods that people would maybe consider to be like junk foods, if you will. And then they come to college and they can eat as much of that food as they want. But then they might reach for that as a coping mechanism whenever they're stressed or I'm feeling emotional or sad. And then they find that they keep feeling that way every day, and then they keep then eating secretively on a daily basis. You know, the same thing with, you know, binging and purging behaviors and overexercise. You know, if someone wants to wake up at 5 a.m. and go run, you know, for 2 hours, who's going to notice in this environment? You know, I'm sure their roommates even are probably sleeping, you know. And so we find that just a lot of those behaviors, you have this unrestricted access. And so we find that they are just, they're practiced in a much more intense level, much more often.
Is there a certain type of eating disorder that seems to be more common in college, or is it fair game kind of?
All of the above. Yeah, all of the above. And I think that there's even a lot of research around binge eating disorder, and I think an underdiagnosis as well, that we're kind of working on and reevaluating that, because it does feel very shameful for people, and it's hard to have that conversation and I think even come to grips with the fact that you might have an eating disorder. And so sometimes we might take a while to label it for somebody because we're still working through that with them. But, I can't say that in my work here, I've necessarily seen, I mean, I'll see much more restrictive behaviors, and we know that there are certain patterns, around statistically. We know that females tend to be more restrictive, males tend to struggle, you know, if they do struggle with an eating disorder, it's more likely to be binging and purging, and then binge eating disorder, as opposed to restrictive nature, that tends to be something that females gravitate towards. But they really don't discriminate. I mean, we find that these behaviors are being practiced amongst all people and even sexualities. So, it was kind of thought that if a male struggled with an eating disorder, well, then he must, be homosexual or gay, and that's not true. It's not true at all. There are absolutely, heterosexual males that struggle with eating disorders. So I do think that there's just a lot of thoughts and misconceptions, and people kind of try to make generalizations, and we really can't.
So I guess what kind of outreach or work do you do as a nutritionist with students who are struggling with eating disorders? I mean, what do you do at that point?
So I work with students definitely one-on-one. If they're more severe, we meet at least weekly, and we definitely talk about proper nutrition and meal planning, what they've been eating and holding them accountable for that. There tend to be a lot of thoughts and feelings around food, and so we talk very much so about what their relationship with food looks like, because we all have a relationship with food, right? And there are some really healthy relationships out there, and there are some really toxic relationships out there, and it's very similar whenever we're looking at our own personal relationship to food. And so I definitely work a lot with students about exploring the function to food and of food and how food is functioning for them. Sometimes we'll even eat together. We might go have a meal on campus and talk about, trying to normalize eating patterns and trying to encourage them to challenge themselves to try something they might be scared of or would never allow themselves. What that might feel like, or if there's a particular food that they haven't eaten in years and they have thoughts and feelings about that, we might work our way up to going and eating that together and challenging that and talking through that as they might be really struggling during and afterwards with what that looks like for them. But the really cool thing is seeing them get through it and seeing that they can accomplish it. And then sitting there and seeing them recognize that like, wow, I haven't eaten that in a year, and I just did, and okay, I'm alive, or I didn't gain 10 pounds from that one slice of pizza. Like, okay, I get it. Like, it's definitely about moderation and really trying to not make foods forbidden, because then once we start attaching that much power to the food, we have no power over it anymore.
I guess speaking a little more broadly, why did you become a nutritionist in the first place?
That's a really good question. I love food. I think food is fun. For me, it kind of started my senior year of high school. My sister was getting married, so naturally, I thought that meant I needed to lose weight, right? Because what else would I think?
Right.
It's just society tells us these things. And so I thought, oh, no, I need to lose weight. And so I started getting really into it, and I had all of my meals and everything planned out. I would eat, you know, like I would eat fruit all day and then have these whole wheat wraps for lunch, and I probably can't touch a wrap again if I even tried. And then I was exercising. I wake up at 5 a.m. every day and go to the gym and exercise every morning. And, you know, it became a little obsessive. I can't deny that. But I, you know, I thought I was doing a really good thing. And I think to a certain point I was. But it was fueled more so by vanity as opposed to really looking at what was healthy and what was good for my body.
Would you qualify that as an eating disorder for you, like that period? Or was it just like
No, it was just disordered.
Okay.
So and there are, and there are spectrums
of that. What's the difference?
Yeah.
Then,
yeah. So when we look at, you know, eating behaviors, you know, we want to look at what's driving them, and then and in terms of, you know, how often are you engaging them, and is it to the point where you are physically unwell, and what does that look like for you, and are you, who's in control, you or the eating disorder, is kind of what we need to look at. So if someone is unable to allow themselves to eat something. I mean, and it, you know, these are just signs and symptoms that we want to consider. So it might be that there are certain foods that they just will not eat and are very uncomfortable eating and won't even if it's like the only thing there. You know, or they get a lot of anxiety around food. So the idea of friends wanting to get together and they want to go out to eat and you have a lot of anxiety about that because mm-hmm. you won't have any control over what restaurant they choose. That's concerning. If there are things that you typically do more in secret, you know, how are you eating alone versus with others? That might be something to really look at. You know, do you ever eat to the point where like you feel sick, and how often do you do that? If you do feel sick, what do you do about that? Do you actually engage in purging, or do you go and exercise, you know, for like 2 hours, you know, 5 days a week, and then, you know, really restrict your calorie intake? Or, you know, are you obsessing over how much you get of one food group and then completely denying yourselves other food groups, or only eating fruits on Monday and vegetables on Tuesday? And that sort of behavior is where we really want to talk about what is this functioning as for you, mm-hmm. and what would it mean to you to give it up?
Right.
Because we find that if you have a very strong connection and it would mean a lot to you to give up these behaviors, then there might be something going on that's much more than just disordered eating.
Right. Go ahead.
Because in terms of disordered eating, we find that we all do this as human beings. Yeah. We have moments that are disordered, right, where we're mm-hmm. not necessarily sitting there balancing it. You know, but again, it kind of goes back to there being functions. I mean, sometimes we'll see this momentarily. It might be, college population. Well, I don't want to eat much at lunch because there's a party tonight, and I'm probably going to drink a lot of calories. So I'm not going to really eat anything at lunch, and I'm going to skip dinner. That way I can save my calories for the party. That's disordered, okay? And it's dangerous,
yeah.
Right? It's very dangerous. But it's not that they have an eating disorder. It's that this is one day and they think what they're doing is appropriate because they're like counting calories and just trying to watch their overall caloric intake as opposed to looking at what their body needs and the fact that it's very dangerous to be dehydrated and undernourished and to go and drink socially like that. So, but that's an example of something that's disordered.
Gotcha. I guess going back, we were talking about you becoming a
nutritionist. Sure. And so then, when I went to my new student orientation, I had applied to college as a biology major, and then I ended up switching my major to nutrition at my new student orientation, and I never changed it because it was very powerful. So I will admit that, you know, nutrition was something that I got interested in out of my own vanity reasons. I definitely had thoughts like, well, if I become a dietitian, then I'll never be fat, right?
Like, right.
That sounds reasonable, a really good idea to, you know, choose a career that way. It sounded very rational to me as an 18-year-old. It ended up being amazing for me because I learned much more about how to respect my body and how to properly nourish it and take care of it, and that what I was doing was not appropriate. And so I'm very glad that I did that, because there's no telling where I would have gone had I not, because I definitely was convinced that what I was doing was wonderful. And, you know, I think there were elements to it that definitely were a little too restrictive.
Well, and I guess going forward, you were mentioning when we were talking before about doing a program with the dining hall where people can learn what food does for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that could be sort of therapeutic, I guess, for people who are struggling with disordered eating to kind of reframe their thoughts around it.
Yeah, because I think a lot of times with food, especially with eating disorders, there are a lot of thoughts that are very negative around food. And we forget that there are a lot of positive properties to food. And that food can be very powerful in terms of disease prevention and giving us energy and reducing our risk for, you know, cancer, diabetes, helping improve our memory. And it's amazing what food can do and what we're finding that food can do, you know, reducing inflammation in our body and all of that amazing stuff. And we tend to focus so much more on food leading to disease as opposed to looking at the foods that help prevent disease. And so I do think that around eating disorders, it's important to reframe that for them and talk about how foods can, yes, be somewhat dangerous, but really it's not the food's fault. It's how we treat the food that makes the bigger difference. Whereas food has a lot of power and can be amazing in terms of antioxidants and everything, but the pizza is not causing obesity. You know, we can't keep blaming the food. We can't, because the food exists as it is. It's how we treat the food, how we eat the food, what that food means to us that's really making the difference. It's not the food itself.
Right. Interesting. Is there a counseling portion of your job?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and in my job, yes, and we call it nutrition. I call it nutrition counseling because food is very personal
right.
to us. And so I will have conversations with students all the time about how food really means something to us, and I think it's important to recognize that and respect it, as opposed to treat food as just fuel, because we don't necessarily learn how our relationship with food molds and shapes our eating patterns.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to just want to follow a diet plan and be really rigid about it until that diet plan no longer works for us, and then we might go off the deep end, so to speak, and just eat all the foods that we've been missing,
yeah.
as opposed to learn how to eat those foods within moderation and responsibly. So we kind of, again, we compartmentalize all these foods as good and bad, and these are okay. And it's funny to me, you find that, you know, we come back on like a Monday morning from work, and we're like, oh my gosh, I was really bad this weekend. And we know that means you ate something. You ate, what did you do? You know, like, oh my gosh, what, you have a donut for breakfast? Like, get out of here. You're so bad. But, you know, in reality, it's like, what does bad really mean? Part of me really wants to be like, oh gosh, like, did you drink and drive? Like, I'm sorry, what did you do that was so bad?
Right.
Because eating a donut is not bad. It's just, and again, but we just put so much emphasis on these behaviors, and we let them define even just, yeah, what, you know, how we performed, and it's just so ridiculous.
Judging them, yeah, attaching judgment.
A lot of judgment, a lot of shame. A lot of shame to have to admit and be like, oh my gosh, I had a donut for breakfast. And it's like, well, did you enjoy it?
Yeah.
I don't really know what to ask you. I'm like, well, that sounds great. So was it, did you go with somebody or just go by yourself? Like, you know, is that something you do normally? I mean, these are the kind of questions that I would ask a client around that. But
right.
In terms of eating disorder treatment on campus, I do want to mention that we do work as a team. So there is, you know, the counseling center on campus is wonderful, and they have clinicians there who specialize with eating disorders. We also have the Center for Students in Recovery, and they have an eating disorder support group that meets weekly. And we will meet weekly as professionals to talk about our clients and make sure that we're all on the same page and that we're setting goals that are appropriate for them, and then we also evaluate, you know, maybe higher level of care, and is, you know, are they safe on campus, or do we need to look at increasing care for them? And so it very much so, if we're looking at eating disorder treatment specifically on campus, they will be working with a therapist and with me, and hopefully going to the eating disorder support group, and we'll be meeting regularly to discuss that client and see if we're meeting their needs.
Okay, well, Sarah Asbury, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure.
We'll tweet a link to the the Wellness Center's Facebook page where you can get a list of those events and learn a little bit more about it. But I'm going to play a little more new music before coming back on and signing off. But thank you so much for coming in studio today. We really appreciate it.
got something on your mind. Tick tock, can I take it for a while? Hey guy, have you got something on your mind? Tick tock, could I take it for a while?
Right. We will be back in studio next Thursday. We have been Mercury Midday News, or I guess I have been. I'm Kara Santucci. I'm the host and producer. We'll be back next Thursday with more news. So we'll be tweeting on our Twitter page. We encourage you to follow it. It's at Merc Midday News, M-E-R-C, Midday News, spelled the normal way. And we'll be posting the Facebook link to Sarah Asprey's Eating Disorder Awareness Week event so that if you're following us, you can find the link and check out what is being offered. But in the meantime, I'm Kara, and I hope you guys have a great rest of your day. The Mercury Midday News is produced by Kara Santucci and co-hosted by Nidhi Gottke. The MMN is a converged product of The Mercury, the student-run newspaper at the University of Texas at Dallas and Radio UTD. Music credits Ben Sound and PurplePlanet.com.